From Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty with the news on this day in Maine, Friday, October 4th, 2019.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by New England Rehabilitation Hospital of Portland, helping patients and their families after illness or injury. Learn more at nerhp.org. And Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens, presenting Gardens Aglow, where visitors will see the gardens in a whole new light. Tickets available at mainegardens.org.
A recent arrest by federal border agents in Maine is raising questions from civil liberties advocates. According to a court affidavit, the officers approached a group of people at a Goodwill in Bangor in late September who, quote, appeared to be of Central American origin and were speaking Spanish. The affidavit doesn't list any other reasons for the stop and says officers arrested one man after he told them he entered the country illegally. Emma Bond is a staff attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union of Maine. She says it is concerning that the agents appeared to rely on race as a reason for questioning the subjects.
All of our rights are at risk when we don't stand up against federal agents targeting people on the basis of their race and national origin.
A regional spokesman for U.S. Customs and Border Protection didn't return a request for comment on the case, which is pending. Border agents have authority to conduct checks within 100 miles of the border, which means all of Maine, and have made stops in various places, including on buses. And an advocacy group for Vermont migrant farm workers is pressuring Maine's Hannaford supermarkets to join a program designed to get more money to dairy workers. VPR's John Dillon has more.
2 years ago, Migrant Justice and Ben & Jerry's signed an agreement that says the ice cream maker will pay farmers more for their product if the farmers provide better pay and working conditions. The group now wants Hannaford's to do the same. The Maine-based chain buys milk for its store brand from Vermont producers. To make their point, Migrant Justice marched to a local Hannaford's in Burlington. Newport farmer Matt Maxwell says the program allowed him to boost worker pay and provide better housing.
I think it would be a good PR move for Hannaford's. A lot of people shop here, and it would make them look really good to the public. You're reaching a lot of people being helped by this Milk with Dignity program in Vermont that otherwise would be subject to some, substandard pay and substandard housing.
In a statement, Hannaford's, which has more than 180 stores in New England and New York, says it expects its suppliers to follow the law and treat their workers humanely. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm John Dillon.
In weather tonight, clear skies with freezes and frosts everywhere but along the coast. Lows overnight in the 20s and 30s. Tomorrow, sunny statewide and calm with highs in the low 50s to the low 60s. And on Sunday, sunny in the morning but becoming overcast in the afternoon. Mainers will not be able to buy recreational marijuana until sometime next year, when the state's expected to put in place all the rules and regulations governing its sale. But as Mal Leary reports, the state also needs to build specialized facilities to handle the cash flow.
Lawmakers approved a set of rules for retail marijuana sales before adjourning in June. But Eric Gunderson, director of the State Office of Marijuana Policy, says lawmakers will need to make some tweaks when they return in January. He says his agency still has a lot of work to do to implement the voter-approved law.
Making sure that we have all the applications put together, making sure we have the correct channels of communication to be able to get the information that we need from different agencies within state government for the application process.
Maine and other states that permit recreational marijuana sales run into one significant snag, he says. Federal law prohibits banks from handling money from those transactions. Jerome Girard, executive director of Maine Revenue Services, says the agency will need to renovate part of its building to include a facility to handle the tax payments that are made in cash. The agency already has several security measures in place, including screening everyone who visits the building.
We've got cameras all around the outside perimeter of the building, places where we are vulnerable, like for electricity entrances, we put jersey barriers.
Additionally, Gerard says, all packages coming into the building will need to be X-rayed, and the guards will carry weapons. And Gerard says the agency is working to address another problem with marijuana. It has a strong smell that gets absorbed by the paper cash, which he says some state workers refuse to handle.
Smells are an issue. Some employees want nothing to do with it for moral reasons and or the smells. What we are doing in the special cash room is we have made sure that we have the strongest air exchange possible.
Gerard says the agency will also use electronic cash counting machines to minimize the contact with staff. He says the facility will easily handle the $3 to $4 million in tax revenue the new law is expected to generate in its first year, and can be expanded to handle more in later years. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
Meanwhile, the longest-running cannabis conference in the Northeast is coming to Maine's largest city this weekend. The Maine Cannabis Convention is at the Portland Sports Complex in Portland on Saturday and Sunday. The event's scheduled to include programs such as legal issues in a growing workforce and new technologies in the cannabis industry. The University of Maine at Presque Isle has received its largest ever grant, which school officials say will allow it to create two new bachelor's degree programs in high-demand, high-wage fields, computer science and health administration. Dr. Deborah Rourke, UMP Executive Director for University Advancement and External Affairs, says each degree program will have two concentrations.
Under our computer science program, we'll actually be offering concentrations in software development and information systems.
And Rourke says within health administration, the concentrations will be community health and health informatics, a field which uses information technology to improve healthcare outcomes. The new programs will be phased in beginning next fall. The grant from the U.S. Department of Education is for nearly $2.25 million over 5 years. It has been 6 weeks since hundreds of asylum seekers, mostly from Africa, had to vacate the Portland Expo, and the housing search for these nearly 450 people continues. More than half have moved into permanent housing, but dozens more families are waiting either in the city's shelter or in the private homes of local hosts. Patty White recently caught up with two families living together in Freeport.
When you get a new roommate, whether you know them or not, you can typically expect to be able to talk with them about how to navigate your new living situation. But when Alex Abbott, Jenny Melville, and their daughter Grace opened their Freeport home to new roommates, they got five of them. And they all speak Lingala, a language from the Democratic Republic of the Congo.
It's probably one of the hardest things is the difficulty of communication.
That's Alex Abbott. His wife, Jenny Melville, says the two families have found a common language, sort of.
Well, we both speak some pretty bad French, and then there's Google Translate. And so between our bad French and Valentin and Julien, they speak good French, so we can communicate. It's not a nuanced communication, but we can get the basics.
Valentin and Julien, who don't want to share their last name because of their asylum case, arrived at Abbott and Melville's door on a Sunday afternoon about a month ago with their three children, ages 2, 4, and 10. It was yet another stop in their months-long journey from the Democratic Republic of the Congo to the U.S. Valentin, speaking through a translator, says they were nervous about moving into a home with strangers.
Just as you know, when you're meeting somebody for the first time that you're not familiar with, you'll feel a little uncomfortable. But it took us a few days to feel very comfortable because we find that they're very good people, caring people.
As a host home, the primary obligation for Abbott and Melville is to provide a temporary place to stay that allows the family to be independent. That means, in part, giving space for Valentin and Julien to store their own food and cook their own meals.
Okay, so we're coming into the kitchen, and you can see this is where we share. So we emptied out this cabinet for them, so they have all their food here, so they don't have to worry about, is this ours, is this yours?
In the kitchen, each family also has their own designated fruit and veggie bowl. Melville then heads upstairs.
And then up here is what was our kids' playroom, and it's a really good thing that I was so lazy and didn't get rid of all the toys.
Just off the playroom, the family of five is split between a guest room and a bedroom that used to be occupied by Melville and Abbott's adult son. Their 17-year-old daughter, Grace, is still at home. She says she wasn't sure at first about becoming a host family because their lives were already so busy. But now she makes a point to spend time with their new roommates, especially the kids.
Because it's really easy to, like, bond with them without language. And my friends love it. Like, we come here and eat lunch here, like, every day, like, in the middle of a school day. And usually Ariel is here, sometimes Blessing's here, and we will draw or play outside.
One of my favorite memories is one night Grace had a whole bunch of her friends over, and we were sitting with John, who's 10, doing a puzzle. And all these guys, all these like 17, 18, 19-year-old guys came in and they were hanging out with him. And this is before he spoke any English. His English is, after just 4 weeks in school, is so much better. And they were just having the best time, like doing this puzzle with him and hanging out with him and relating to him. And they had, you know, no language in common.
The two families have formed a connection, though the details of why Valentin and Julian left the Democratic Republic of the Congo are unclear. Valentin declined to talk about it during our interview. Regardless of what led them to Maine, Gray says it's just nice to experience people from a different culture on a daily basis.
In Freeport, where I live, it's a pretty sheltered place, and we don't have a ton of exposure to different ways of life, different people at all, really. There's not a ton of diversity in any context, so it's cool, and it's just new people to bond with.
And Valentin says, even in a short period of time, his family has learned many things about American culture from the Abbott Melville family.
Things that stood out to me, all with the American culture, is the fact that, first of all, they're very strict in terms of time. They tend to keep the time. That's something we naturally never do. And second, honesty. They really want us to be honest. Besides, they don't keep grudge.
As hosts, Melville says her family has tried not to interfere with their guests' lives, but they have helped with things like registering the kids for school and connecting the family to English lessons. She says she asked Valentin and Julian early on whether that was okay. Valentin says he almost can't believe how helpful the family has been.
We were puzzled by their welcome, because even people who are from our country, our kinsmen, will never welcome us the way they did. How can you live under the same roof with people that you don't know, people you're not familiar with? And we feel like what they have done is a lifetime lesson for us, that we should never discriminate people, no matter how they look, they're still human beings. And we believe that we're very grateful to this family, and wherever we'll go, we'll never forget them.
On Saturday, the family's moving into their own place in Portland. But Valentin says they'll be back to visit, because in the U.S., he says, Alex, Jenny, and Grace are the closest thing to family they have. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
And on Monday, you can tune into Maine Calling for a conversation and update on the status of asylum seekers in Maine. Journalist Martin Smith is no stranger to Saudi Arabia or its key players.
I had interviewed the Crown Prince before, and I had met with Jamal Khashoggi several times.
After Khashoggi was killed a year ago and the Crown Prince implicated in the act, Smith and the PBS program Frontline decided it was time to take a closer look at Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Smith spoke about this today at Colby College, and he told Maine Public's Morning Edition host Erwin Gratz on Thursday that the Crown Prince, MBS, as he is known, is a complex figure.
Well, I think it's correct that he is a reformer, but that shouldn't be confused. In other words, he's interested in economic reform. He's interested in some social reforms in order, for instance, to bring women into the workforce. But what he's not interested in is political reform that would give people a voice. He's not interested in a free press. He's not interested in people's right to self-determination. And I think in the West, a lot of people had great hopes for him. And when they saw that he was a reformer, an economic reformer, they confuse that with this idea that he would be something of a Democrat, if you could imagine such a thing in a monarchy.
You know, I just thought about this, but there's a parallel here, is there not, with what we're seeing in China today?
There is a parallel with China, and that's very much a model for him, I believe. The problem is that China has a huge industrious, hardworking
workforce. And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org and join us tomorrow on Maine Calling
at 1 o'clock
for a conversation about the dance scene in Maine.
To the world.
I'm Nora
Flair. So many goods are manufactured there. Saudi Arabians, by and large, haven't really learned what it is to work. There's an elite at the very top, but after that, you've got massive unemployment, and people have become accustomed to, with great wealth, hiring people from outside the country, whether it's Pakistanis or Bangladeshis or Filipinos, to come in and do their work. And interestingly, when I met Jamal Khashoggi a couple of times ago, back in 2016, I believe it was, I asked him what he was doing, and he said he was getting ready to write a book on how Saudis didn't understand the value of work.
Your documentary talks about how increasingly Saudi Arabia began to reach out for its expatriates who were in some ways dissenting from the government. Did Khashoggi realize how much mortal danger he was in?
He certainly did not seem to realize that he was in mortal danger. And there is, and we probably undercooked this in this documentary, because there's many examples of people being kidnapped or forcibly removed from other countries and brought back to Saudi Arabia. In the last year, there's been, I think, at least four that we know of, and one of those people is missing. So Jamal should have known that he was at some risk, but I think especially going into the consulate building in Istanbul. So unfortunately, he made that decision to go in there, and he did it out of love. He did it because he wanted marriage papers for him and his fiance.
Has the international outrage that has followed Khashoggi's death had any impact on MBS that you can tell?
I think he thought this was going to blow over. But I think what's happened instead, to some degree, not enough, is that the murder and dismemberment and the whole gruesomeness of this all has opened a window on Saudi Arabia, and people have been able to look a little harder at what's going on there. And the fact that women's rights activists, poets, academics, authors of various kinds have been in prison and swept up in purges, starting really with his ascendance as the crown prince in early 2017. So Khashoggi allowed people to take a harder look. Somehow we all kind of woke up and said, wait a minute.
Now, of course, you're here to be part of Colby's convocation regarding journalists and the dangers that journalists have been facing around the world. What's your message to people like you who continue to do what you do?
Well, it's our jobs to ask hard questions of people in power. It's our job to go to places that other people might be hesitant to go to and cover them. The wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and Syria have all been my beats. And it's, you know, I'm not going to say that it's safe, but it's part of the job. And there are a lot of people in other countries who face far graver dangers than I do as an American. And my hat's off to those people, and many of them have lost their lives. Increasingly, the U.S. administration has decided to take a hostile stance towards reporters. And this emanates out from the U.S., and it emboldens people such as dictators in other countries, Duterte or wherever, Putin. I mean, so there is an open sort of season on journalists now, and that's unfortunate. As an American journalist, I'm much safer for the most part, even though some Americans have lost their lives doing their work. But my sympathies go out to those people who are in countries that are oppressive and who take enormous risks as journalists.
Colby College presents its Lovejoy Award in the name of Khashoggi and other journalists killed last year. The award's named for Elijah Lovejoy, a Colby alumni killed defending his press from a pro-slavery mob. And that's today's Maine News. For more stories, visit mainepublic.org. Have a great weekend. I'm Nora Flaherty.